demanding the rights of we the people, broadcasting the truth, the puppet media dare not report. Long live liberty and death to the new world order. Prepare yourself. This is the alternative media.
Okay, and welcome back to the show, Hour 3 of the Alternative Media. I am your fill-in host, Patrick Slattery. We are here with a new guest, a new great guest, and this is Professor Richard Sloan, and he is a professor of creative writing. He's also a script writer. He's written scripts in Hollywood. He's got a great deal of experience. Professor Sloan, are you there? Okay, maybe we're having a little bit of trouble getting him. As soon as he's there, let's make sure that... All right. So he'll be with us in just a second. In the meantime, just before the break, we were talking about the Trump campaign with Professor McDonald. And... there's a certain amount of pessimism right now after him losing Wisconsin by a considerable margin. But I stated that I'm optimistic. I know there are problems with all sorts of rules bending, rules changing. They're going to try to do. There's going to be a lot of shenanigans going on at the convention, and I know that Donald Trump got off to a slow start in understanding. The delegate game, and the game goes beyond just winning votes and supposedly winning delegates, because the delegates are individuals, and our system was not just a democratic system that all of a sudden appeared. The convention system, it was parties, and parties were private organizations. It goes back to the 1830s, and the delegates. We're not typically elected.
The break, we're talking about the Trump campaign.
I'm hearing a bit of an echo, and does that mean that we have a guest now? Professor Sloan, are you there? Professor Sloan. Okay, we're having a little bit of technical trouble, but he's with us. We're just not getting connected properly yet. That will come in just a second. So the delegates are actually humans. The humans get to vote. Rules have changed. Rules have evolved. And, primaries only – the first primary was only, I believe, the 1908 election. And as recently as 1968, there was only about 12 primaries that were held. And the rest of the states had caucuses, which were dominated by an establishment. So this is the expectation that the person who wins the most votes in the primaries is going to be the nominee. Well, this has been the case for the past few decades, since the 1970s, but it's not written in stone. It's not written in the rules. Whoever gets the most delegates voting for them will win the nomination. But the thing is that I think that a lot of the shenanigans they're thinking about now, if Trump wins big in New York, which it looks like he's going to, wins big in some other states, I think what you're going to have is a lot of the neocons who dominate the Republican Party right now. They're going to look and say, okay, well, we can try to block Trump from getting the nomination. We'll split the party. We'll lose. Hillary will win, and we'll be on the outside. Or they can just say, like some of them, like Robert Kagan, who's the founder of the Project for the New American Century, which was neocon central. There, some of them are already saying, "Hey, let's just go with Hillary. Hillary's fine." I mean, these neocons, they're warmongers. Hillary's a warmonger. The neocons really don't care about traditional values, conservative values. They don't care about that. Neither does Hillary. Hillary's perfect for them. And I think a lot of them are just would rather be on the winning side, formally on the winning side, and they'll we'll probably move over to Hillary, and it'll make it somewhat, there will be less resistance to Trump then, especially if they think that, that Trump's not going to be a viable candidate. Is our guest ready? Can he hear us?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Great. Okay. Professor Sloan, so good for you to be with us.
My pleasure.
Okay, so you have been a Hollywood scriptwriter. You've been a professor of creative writing, and you know, both academia and Hollywood are these are areas where you do have a great deal of power held by a small ethnic minority. And we don't have to focus entirely on that, but I know we've talked about the way that commercials, for instance, that you're so likely to see commercials nowadays where you've got some goofy white people doing stupid things, and then maybe non-whites, typically a black person who solves their problems. Whether this is the Michael Jordan's commercials where he's got these goofy white people asking him about his underwear and he gives them, you know, strange looks, or a bunch of insurance commercials that feature you know, white people who've just had some stupid accident, run into a tree or a fire hydrant, and then the black insurance agents there to save the day. How does this happen? Is it that there's some elders of Zion somewhere handing down directives to Madison Avenue, saying, telling the copywriters to write the commercial this way, or is it through some other means that we see this thing?
I've never seen a memo, or I've never heard of a memo that said make white people look stupid at the expense of non-whites. But the reason I think that it happens is because there was a time when, you know, the media was mostly, if not entirely, white, and you would have inspired casting. Somebody would be, you know, casting a courtroom scene, and they would say, hey, let's make the judge black. It gives it kind of another dimension. It includes audience members, you know, draws them more into the product that otherwise wouldn't be drawn in. And in the beginning, it was kind of, if you think back, you know, the first time you saw like a Sidney Poitier or a really exciting, you know, black character in a film, it was inspiring. But then what happens is the ones that don't have the non-whites begin to look racist by default, or at least that's the name that that, you know, your social justice warriors want to give them. And it gets to where every film, every television show, every commercial has to sort of be a microcosm of this multicultural universe. You can't make a commercial now that has three white people in it and no persons of color in it without somebody somewhere calling you a racist. So as a creator of a commercial, if you're a Wall Street executive, or I'm sorry, a Madison Avenue executive, or if you're a creator of a film, or if you're in a, you know, if you're doing development for a television show, you would want to include persons of color, partly because they'll, you know, they may give your work another dimension, but partly there's the fear that, you know, even if your point of view is white and you come from a white world and you want to talk about whites, if you don't put in, you know, an Asian character here, a white character there, or a Hispanic character there, there's the danger that somebody's going to call you racist. And there are groups that picket films, or that demand meetings with the producers and demand inclusion. You know, my response to them always is, you know, there's nobody that's excluding you from going and making your own. You know, like, there's one Asian columnist I know who his job as he's defined it, the niche that he's cut out for himself, is every day he watches television and he has a notebook and he makes a note of which shows have Asian characters and how integral those Asian characters are to the plot, vis-a-vis how stereotypical they are. And then he reports on them in his column. You have people doing that. And that guy is also a member of a group that they picketed the film Rising Sun, for an example, or they wanted to take a meeting with the producers of Pearl Harbor. There was a movie about Pearl Harbor, and his objection, this particular columnist who I'm talking about, his objection to Pearl Harbor is when you saw Pearl Harbor being bombed, all of the victims and everybody panicking on the street, they were all white. And he points out, well, there were a lot of Asians in Hawaii. But obviously, if you look at it from the filmmaker's point of view, if you put too many Asians on the street, your audience will get confused. Am I looking at Hawaii, or am I now looking at Tokyo?
Right. Well, I remember seeing a 1930s era Japanese poster or book or something about Hawaii, and just making the comment that that Honolulu looked like a Japanese city. It was so there's that. I was once involved in the production of a little commercial for a local product, and the commercial just had a little girl in it. But the little girl wasn't black, and one of our board members came back and said, "Well, you know, if you want black people to buy this product, you have to have a black person in the commercial." Well, it wasn't necessarily a product that was or it was aimed at blacks, but I've always wanted to take a notebook and jot down the commercials and who's doing what in the commercials. But if I was to do so, you would see an awful lot of commercials for products that aren't likely to have blacks as a very big portion of their consumers. And I'm thinking of like financial planning products, wealth management, and you know your wealth management target audience is probably not going to be very heavily black. Yet they will very often have blacks in these commercials for products that aren't aimed at blacks. So why is it? So on the one hand, I had this black board member tell me, if you want to sell products to blacks, you have to have blacks in the commercial. Just told me that flat out. On the other hand, all these products aimed at whites still have blacks in the commercial. And how does that happen?
Yes, well, I think you answered that question once, and I gave you the answer historically, like how it came to be that there was a consciousness, a conscious effort to include non-whites in film and in television and in commercials. But now I'll answer your question about how it happens now. In today's world, I think it's a runaway train. I think it's a case of, you know, the grass was very dry, and maybe the 1940s, 1950s, there weren't a lot of blacks in film. We started casting them in different roles, and it was cool, and it was inspired in the beginning. And, you know, it was like turning on the sprinkler for a dried lawn, and you give your lawn water. Well, now the sprinkler's been on way too long, and now the lawn is starting to overflow, and we're having unnatural pictures of the world just because companies feel like there's this diversity mandate. So you and I were talking the other day about how commercials get made, and you were sitting in your office, and I said, just as a thought experiment, look around your office and tell me a product, tell me what you see. And you looked around your office and you saw some paper. And I said, okay, let's say I'm an advertising exec and I want to write a snappy, memorable, engaging commercial about paper. Gone are the times where we would just have one person talking to the screen with a ream of paper in their hand and telling you the benefits of the paper. You would want to have some sort of, you know, dramatic piece. When I say drama, I mean, you know, with dialogue, people talking to each other, not necessarily very serious. Actually, it would be better if it was funny. You would want to have some sort of drama, some sort of conflict, some sort of dialogue to draw people into it and to get them into your world and to get them interested in why this paper is good. So I just came off the cuff when we were talking the other day on the phone. I came up with the idea of, okay, let's say you're in an office and there's a guy at his computer and he's working on something, and then he hits print and he walks over to the printer and he takes out the document that he printed and it's smudged, and he crumbles it up and he puts it in the trash can, and he goes back and he fixes some things on his computer, pushes print again, goes back to the printer and he pushes print this time, and there's a paper jam, or it comes out and it's not properly aligned or something. And so he tears that piece up and he goes and he messes with his computer a little bit more. And then when he gets up to go to the printer again, another guy in the office says, "Hey, you're disturbing me. I don't want you to be walking back and forth like this all day. You know what? Use Acme paper." and he gives the guy a ream of the quality paper. And the guy puts that in the printer, and it prints up perfectly. You know, problem solved. We all kind of enjoyed that little you know, problem and solution play that we saw. And so we may remember the brand of printer. Okay, so that's my concept. I pitch it to the client. The client says, yes, go out and shoot that commercial. Now you, Dr. Slattery, are the casting director. How are you going to cast this? You've got two characters. You've got the dumb idiot who doesn't know what kind of paper to put in his printer, and you've got the guy who he's disturbing, who's a little smarter, who knows what the quality paper should be. Are you gonna cast the dumb idiot who doesn't know any better as the black guy? You're gonna make
no. That would fight? Be racist.
Yes, to cast the guy that doesn't know what kind of paper to buy as the non-white person, you could get accused of racism. To cast both players as white in today's world, I think it's crazy, but this is the way the world is. People actually make these claims. You know, four band members in a group and they're all white and they're called racist. You know, three characters on a commercial and they're all white and people say they're racist. So you got to put in one person of color. A black person is a good person of color to put in because he's obviously black. If he's Hispanic, you know, you may miss that it's a person of color. If it's Asian, people may make the claim, you know, it's not enough diversity. So you should put in a black person. But I think you and I both agree that the only character that could be black in a scenario like that, if the company wants to play it safe, is the smart character who knows what the better brand of paper is.
Okay, so that's yes. Right. Okay. How about movies now? We've got all these movies, and it's when was the first time Morgan Freeman became president? I mean, he's been president in a bunch of movies, it seems like. That seems to be
he's
now
been
a.
God too.
Excuse me?
He's been God as well.
Oh, he's been. Oh, yeah, right. He's been God.
And the first time I
how
saw
how many times has he been God? He was God in the Twilight Zone, wasn't he?
Hmm?
Wasn't he God in the Twilight Zone? And that was in the 90s, I believe, or 80s even.
Yeah, the first time I saw Black God, I thought, wow, that's, you know, that's kind of neat. You know, some black people are going to be going to the theater. They're going to see themselves as God. Audiences have never seen a black person as God. The first time you see black people, you saw black people casted in positions of power where they were minor characters. You know, they could have been black or they could have been white, and it wouldn't really have changed the story. But let's have them be black, and, you know, it's kind of different. In the beginning, it was fun, but it just sort of, you know, became the rule. It sort of took over. If you're casting a movie and, you know, it's a courtroom case and, you know, you've got lawyers arguing against each other, you could make one black if your property allows for that kind of fungibility. If you could make that change and it wouldn't change everything else, you could make one of the attorneys black. But the easiest person to make black is the judge, because the judge basically just kind of sits there and rules, and the judge doesn't have to win anybody's respect. He already has the respect going in. And you know, the president or God or somebody like that. Very, very smart move from the point of view of the producers is to cast that person of authority who's not necessarily the central character as black. Mm-hmm. Now, there have been critics of the media, critics of television and film, who have coined a term, the Palmer effect or the David Palmer effect.
So what's the David Palmer effect?
Well, David Palmer is the name of the character in the exciting FBI Fed thriller 21, where Kiefer Sutherland was your star, and Kiefer Sutherland was trying to keep terrorists and keep terrorists at bay and prevent an assassination.
Okay, we've got the break music coming up. We're going to have you finish that story when we come back. This is the alternative media. We'll be back after the break.
We'll be right back.
We are back. This is the Alternative Media with Patrick Slattery, and we are here with Professor Richard Sloan. And you were explaining something about the Palmer effect.
Yes, this is a term coined by a media critic who argued that America was the pathway to electing a black president was paved by such portrayals of black presidents as that in the TV show 24. This is a very popular TV show. It came out shortly after 9/11 when Americans were very concerned about security. Kiefer Sutherland plays a character, Jack Bauer, who's trying to protect the president of the United States from assassination attempt. And, the name of the president of the United States was David Palmer. He could have been anybody. They cast him as a black man. You've heard the expression, seeing is believing. Well, that's one of the interesting things about film and about television is you can create a reality that's not yet a reality in the real world, but people see it, and the television shows that we watch and the movies that we see, they become our experience. Our subconscious doesn't know quite how to separate reality from fantasy as well as you might think that your brain does. When we see things, they become part of our memory. When we sort of live a movie, we know it's a movie. We know we're watching fiction, but the experience gets stored away. Like you might see something that you've never seen and you have no experience of prior to seeing that movie. Like you might see a slaughterhouse in a movie and you've never been to a slaughterhouse. And that picture of what a slaughterhouse is, that's where you go to when somebody mentions a slaughterhouse to you. That's your only memory of it. That's your only picture of it in your brain, and it's a picture that was created by set designers somewhere. It's not probably a true picture of a true slaughterhouse. So Americans saw a black president, not just in 24. There have been other examples, but the term, the David Palmer effect, came from 24, and it's the idea that seeing a black president in our living room who looked presidential sort of undid the prejudice against a black president. You know, we could never have a black president because, you know, blacks are athletes or blacks are musicians. Well, now Americans have enough experience with seeing blacks as presidents that, they could envision one being in the White House.
Okay, yeah, so and you had David Palmer character, you had Morgan Freeman's character. How about in the Martian Invasion, wasn't there a black president too?
Are you talking about the movie The Martian with Matt Damon?
No, I'm talking about like there was one like where the Mars was invading the Earth or something like that. I don't know. And now we have a black president. So it kind of socialized us to the idea of thinking of blacks as making good presidents. Now in the news, this isn't necessarily in Hollywood, but you could probably think of plenty of Hollywood examples. But in the news, you have all of these stories that are really publicized about the innocent black, usually petty criminals or sometimes hardcore criminals, but these blacks, sometimes completely innocent, but usually, you know, something's going on, who are victimized by the police. And, and then you get all these commentators saying, black commentators saying, I'm afraid to leave my house. I'm afraid to walk down the street because I'm going to get killed by the police. And, of course, the actual crime data shows that whites are vastly more likely to be victims of violent crime by black criminals than vice versa. And of course, anybody listening to this, if you live near a city, you know parts of those cities are pretty much no-go zones. Yet the idea of the blacks having to cower in fear about violent whites, this is kind of permeated. This has become an idea that's kind of become hegemonic in the news, and a lot of whites seem to even believe it. Do you think this is that kind of the same effect, like the Palmer effect? Well, we got another break. Think about your answer, and we'll get to you right after the break. And we'll start taking that. Number is 1-800-313. I love that song. We are back. This is the Alternative Media. I am Patrick Slattery, your host, and we are here with Professor Richard Sloan. And you were talking just before the break.
Yes, you'd asked me to give my opinion on the frequent coverage of white-on-black crime and the relative lack of coverage of black-on-white crime in the media. I want to take a quick step back to the David Palmer effect, because when we were finishing off, I didn't want to give anybody the impression that the idea is that Americans were brainwashed into accepting a black president because of David Palmer. The idea is just that it became more palatable. It became more acceptable. And just as a quick example, you know who the comedian Don Rickles is?
I certainly do.
I saw Don Rickles on David Letterman. This was probably, it was before Obama was elected, so it was probably like 2005 or something. And I can't remember the lead up to the joke, but, you know, somebody said something and he said, yeah, tell me about it. When that happens, we're going to have a Jewish pope and we're going to have a black president.
Well, we have both.
Yeah, Don Rickles paused and he waited for the laugh. We have both now, but I mean, this was before Obama. He paused and he waited for the laugh.
A little bit about Francis, but not all that much.
Right. Don Rickles was shocked that his audience wasn't with him, because Don Rickles, you know, he came into his own in like the 60s and 70s, and he was used to a different sensibility. And, you know, by saying, yeah, that'll be the day. When that happens, you know, sure, we'll have a Jewish pope and a black president. He thought he'd get a big laugh. And the audience kind of like, you know, turned on him. And, you know, there were some hisses because this was pre-Obama. But the audience could envision a black president. The audience had the idea, well, why can't a president be black? And, you know, I think hopefully your audience would agree that it wasn't a case of brainwashing, but by seeing, you know, these credible examples in fiction, in, you know, fictive narratives, we kind of get the idea. We kind of think, oh yeah, well, that could work. Why not? Well, anyway, so your question was white on black crime in the media. That's been going on for a long time. There was somebody who wrote a book called The View from Sunset Boulevard, and I think that book came out as late as like 1979. I could be wrong. Maybe it was early 80s. It was either late 70s or early 80s. And the guy examined, you know, all of the crime shows like Hawaii Five-0 and the Rockford Files and Beretta. And at the end of the show, who did the bad guy wind up being? And he said, there's a huge disconnect between which races commit crimes in real life and which races commit crimes in, you know, television and films. This was either the late 70s or early 80s. And this trend of, you know, like more non-white heroes and more white villains has just, you know, continued without any sort of breaks for the last several decades. And I want to say that historically, I kind of agree with the idea. Even if, you know, like 99% of all rapes were happening by non-whites, and there were very few white people ever raping anybody, to occasionally, like, you know, like famous example is To Kill a Mockingbird, mm-hmm. where everybody just assumed, I don't know how well you know the movie, Gregory Peck defends a black man who in the South is accused of rape, and everybody just assumes, yes, because he's black, he must have raped her, and it turns out that he couldn't have raped her because she said he grabbed her with one arm that he couldn't move well, and, you know, Gregory Peck gets him off, and all of the blacks applaud as he walks out of the courtroom. To have balance in that way, even if films like that and television shows like that sort of overrepresented white crime, to have a little bit of that, you know, it just seemed like, let's put a little bit of that out there in the world. Let's not make it like make moviegoers and television audiences feel like all blacks have to be criminals and whites can never commit crimes. Let's turn it around now and then, because, you know, ultimately, we want to create a better world. That's the kind of world we want to see. But it's like leaving the sprinklers on. You know, in the beginning, your lawn needs the water. You leave the sprinklers on too long, your lawn gets flooded. Now you can't really have black criminals. You know, you get called a racist for that. So now all of the devious string pullers behind the scenes of, all of your villains, they have to be white. And something like the Trayvon Martin case, in my view, obviously, most of what I'm saying is just opinion. This isn't a science. I've just looked at a lot of media and I've come up with my own analysis. I don't think that my perception is that. And this I know for a fact. I know that a lot of people who work in news, a lot of people who are journalists, they dream of being screenwriters. They want to write for movies. You know, they do a portrait of some real figure, but they're hoping it will get picked up, and they're hoping it will be made into a movie. And everybody knows the movie language. Everybody understands film syntax, and this narrative style of telling stories the way we tell stories in films and in television, it has been adopted by the news. The news often presents news stories as though they were television, as though they were film. You know, they've got a few jokes that they've worked into it, and you know, they keep a few pieces to the end of the story for dramatic effect. And, you know, they want you to stay with them just like a movie would or a film would. Whereas in journalism, what you're supposed to do is you're supposed to give the most important information first, and then you're supposed to, you know, give the details later. But they don't always do that. So the point I was trying to get around to is, I think that even people in the news media, whose job it is to present news, when they see yet another story of black-on-white crime, say, to them it's not really news, because it's sort of like dog bites man versus man bites dog. They don't want to throw out another instance of black on white crime. And you probably already know this, and maybe you talk about it on your show. Lots of crimes committed by non-whites against whites, the non-white identity of the criminal, even when the crime is reported on, it's often obscured. Often you hear, you know, man kills a black woman, you know, coming out of restaurant. And unless you see the picture, or you watch it on the news and they've got a picture of the subject, you don't realize that the man who killed the black woman was himself a black man. They leave that part out. And I think it's just sort of the sense that they have, because, you know, that's the balance that we try to achieve in our fiction, though I think we've gone overboard. Mm-hmm. And I think they want to achieve the same thing in reporting the news. What I want to say about Trayvon Martin is, it wasn't to me an unusual story. Horrible things like that happen all the time. The unusual thing about Trayvon Martin is George Zimmerman was a white, or a more or less white person.
He was described as a white, but of course he was half Hispanic. He was no more white really than Obama, but yes.
And his victim was black. Mm-hmm. And this is the story. If you've got a real life story of a poor black person that is being wrongly attacked in a racist way, and you can get the rights to that story, and you could do a film version of it or a television version of it. You're very close to a sale because that's where the market is. That's where producers are. That's, you know, what people want to see. And I think the same thing works even in journalism. Even in journalism, you know, if you go through the police blotter, there's so much crime committed by minorities, and you just kind of flip through it. There's not going to be any, you know, there's not going to be, it's not going to be a big badge for you to cover that story. Whereas if you can find it the other way around, they're actually a lot harder to find, as you probably know, but you find it the other way around, and look at what a spectacle Trayvon Martin was.
The crime of the decade, at least.
Yeah, and all it was is you know, a neighborhood watch type person saw a suspicious person that he thought was going to be breaking into houses, confronts him. Both of them were kind of jerks, in my view, Trayvon Martin as well as George Zimmerman. It winds up, it sadly resulted in one of them getting shot.
Right, and Trayvon,
but it happens every
according
day.
To all the forensic evidence, Trayvon seems to have initiated the violence and started beating him. But I wasn't there, you weren't there.
Neither of us were there. But the point that I was trying to make is it wasn't so unusual as crimes go. You know, it wasn't like, you know, somebody...
Well, to the extent it was unusual, you know, obviously there's at least five times as many... In terms of interracial crimes, whites being murdered by blacks is the other way around. So
yes, the only unusual aspect of it was race.
Mm-hmm.
It, apart from race, it was a very typical crime that sadly happens a lot. And yet, why was it that one crime was, right, to use your words, the crime of the decade, the biggest thing since O.J.? O.J. was big because O.J. was a celebrity.
Mm-hmm.
Even though there was a race element to that one too, but this was, you know, this was just neighborhood watch guy, overeager neighborhood watch guy against, you know, possible robber, possible just, you know, guy on a walk eating Skittles, and it escalates into one of them getting killed. Okay. Sadly, it happens a lot, right, but why does no one notice any of those other crimes?
So and just. You know, it seems as if, getting back to what we were talking about at the very beginning, part of it is that the scriptwriters for commercials know what's the market is for them. The journalists know what's expected. They don't have to get a directive from the elders of Zion. They know what's expected. They know what's going to sell to, you know, the, in this case, to their editors, and when you know, or the editors know what's going to sell to the publishers, the publishers to the owners, and when you have a Jewish-dominated ownership that does have an agenda, that agenda seems to trickle down.
Yeah, I would agree with all of that.
Well, we still have time. There's something else I want to get to, if you don't mind.
Sure.
And you've mentioned some old films, and there are new films too. With the old movie stars, there were Jewish movie stars going way back, and of course Hollywood is kind of the Jewish empire of their own. It's kind of a Jewish industry from the get-go, even though they didn't invent the technology. But in the you can think of a generation ago, the Jewish stars like Tony Curtis or Kirk Douglas, they took non-Jewish names, and they were not very Jewish in appearance, and it was at a time where probably the regular population knew a little, you know, thought of Jews, were more likely to think of Jews as outsiders and more likely to be able to recognize them. And nowadays, the big, you know, you think of big stars like Ben Stiller or David Schwimmer, or, you know, there are a lot of Jewish stars who have very Jewish appearances, Jewish names, and people don't seem to be aware of it. Or, you know, what I'm getting at is that Jewish appearances, Jewish personalities, Jewish accents, Jewish facial characteristics have been kind of mainstreamed, and it seems to me it's reinforces what I call this asymmetry of recognition, where Jews are able to recognize other, you know, other Jews as their in group, Gentiles are not able to, they don't know who Jews are, they don't know the difference. And so there seems to have been this change in casting. Am I just paranoid, or is there something to this?
Well, I would agree. I mean, we can only just sort of guess at the reason why. I haven't studied this, but you get a Dustin Hoffman, and he's accepted, and audiences like him, and he has kind of a Jewish look. And then you get a David Schwimmer, and he's in Friends, and he's there's some Aryan-looking blonde chicks that he hangs out with, and you know, he's just one of the guys, and people accept him. And you know, the more of them you see, I would think the more that you would be open to accepting. I think it's the same principle as the David Palmer effect or any sort of effect like that is and also maybe it's just a function of, you know, look at America. America, you see a lot more, you know, sort of diversity and a lot more obvious ethnic features than you would have seen, you know, 30 years ago. Anyway, I don't know if that's the answer you were looking for or not, but I think there's probably a number of answers and a number of reasons. But I would agree that, yes, the phenomenon that you're noticing, I've noticed too. Mm-hmm. An excellent example is Superbad. None of those three kids that carried the movie Superbad could have been leading actors, could have carried a movie in the 1980s or the 1990s.
I don't know the movie Superbad. Maybe some of our audience hasn't. What was that?
It was three very Jewish-looking kids, or at least two very Jewish-looking kids trying to get laid, and the other maybe sort of being comic relief. But they just, you know, you're talking about Jewish features. They just looked very, very, I don't know, I guess less the Kirk Douglas and more the David Schwimmer. Mm-hmm. But you don't know the actors, so I can't put the images in your head.
Okay. There are these stereotypes, the white stereotypes, which have become increasingly negative. I mean, it goes back. You think of the Marx Brothers movies from the 30s, and you know the Marx Brothers. Anybody in the 30s would have been able to identify at least Groucho as being kind of a Jewish type, and he would make certain jokes. I remember one joke. He said, "I would never belong to a club that would have me as a member," which was a reference to some social clubs that didn't accept Jews as a member. And he was like, "I wouldn't belong to such a club that wouldn't have me as a member."
I didn't know that it was a reference to that.
Yeah, that's what it was a reference to. And there was a woman, a kind of overweight woman, who was in a lot of the movies as kind of a foil for his. I forgot her name, but
she was love interest.
Right, and she was very waspy. She was brought on as kind of the waspy. She was, you know, upper class and had money that she didn't earn. And so, using that as a starting point, you start getting to, you know, Rodney Dangerfield or Jackie Mason, who are always very sympathetic Jewish characters, salt of the earth, but they've made their own money. Okay, we're having our last break. We're going to be back for one last segment. And it's Patrick Slattery with Professor Richard Sloan. And we are back. The alternative media. We have just a few more minutes, so let's try to bring this back full circle. I was just getting at before the break, the various stereotypes, you've had increasingly pro-Jewish stereotypes, increasingly anti-Jewish, anti-European-American stereotypes, you know, waspy stereotypes. But with instead of ranting more about movies, and we're at an age where we might tend to rant, what we were getting at the beginning of the show is there doesn't have to be directives sent out from Conspiracy Central. There's kind of, just as in economics, Adam Smith talked about an invisible hand that moved the market. A lot of the very same forces are at work here. And it's but the thing is, Adam Smith's idea about the market, you know, the market was suppliers, producers, and consumers. and there was consumer demand. I don't really think this is so much consumer demand, but I do think that you have it's kind of like a market. The people at the top, well, the people at the bottom, they know what's good for their career, and as you pointed out, they'll do this because they know what's expected of them. People at the top, when you get up to the producers, you get up to the owners, they're also motivated by interest, but it's tribal interest, the way I see it, and so the result seems to be you get very similar results from this as you would from a Elders of Zion type conspiracy, but you don't have to have everybody meeting at the top. Even though there are trade associations, there are Jewish organizations, there's the Conference of Presidents of 50 major Jewish organizations. There is some meeting at the top, but you don't have to have this secret government and the all the formal tentacles. Is that how you would? Do you see it that way as well, Professor?
Yes. And as you were saying that, I was trying to think of sort of an analogy to hammer home your point. And I thought of the Chinese. I thought the China economy is huge now, and there is some Chinese money that's coming into film, and there's advertising tie-ins, and so there is the incentive from the top to include, sort of more of China and more of the Chinese in film and in novels and in television. But I think the average person just senses that China is in the air more, so let's throw a Chinese character in. I don't think the average writer at sort of like, the development level is thinking, we can sell this project to this production company and half of their budget is going to come from China. They just sense that, you want to be part of you want to be part of the jam. You sort of play, you play the same song that everybody else is playing. A lot of Chinese, I'm not talking about like Asian Americans, I'm talking about ethnic Chinese. I've seen a lot of them in film lately, and I'm not sure that they were always directives from the top. You can tell sometimes when they seem to be, when they're like inorganic, when, why is that Chinese character there? He shouldn't be there. But often it's just like, well, Chinese are all around the world now. The economy is booming and Chinese are everywhere. Let's throw one in this film, or let's throw one in my television show. Does that somehow support what you were saying?
Yeah, I think it does. Okay, well, thank you so much for coming on. And, Professor, I hope you'll be able to come on again. Maybe we can have a panel. Maybe we can have a panel with Don Advo and you and talk about some of this stuff. That would be great. All right. So thank you so much to our audience for listening. We'll be back again a week from now, and I believe I'm still hosting. Farron will be back eventually, but I'm be your host. So thank you. This is Patrick Slattery, and we'll be back again next week.